822, Harrison Bass versus State. We have Mr. Johns and Mr. Sorensen for the appellant. We have Mr. Conrad Hafen, who's a member of the Attorney General's Office, for the respondent. And take your time setting up. And I'll make a record that Justice Seda has been excused for today, but she will listen to this oral argument when she returns. Mr. Johns, will you be arguing this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Sorensen, will you be able to hear, or do you need to sit closer? And I apologize that we don't have the equipment that the district court has.
Great difficulty with the acoustics in this room. I've got my earpieces in, and so I'll tell him whether I feel adequate to even do a response.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sorensen, and I again apologize that we don't have the equipment. Let me make the statement also that, again, some of you were here when I made the opening statement that we are the Northern Nevada, Northern panel, they call us, as opposed to the Southern panel of it's Justice Gibbons, Justice Seda, and myself. The Southern panel is Justice Perigary, Justice Douglas, and Justice Pickering. We've asked that this name of our panel be changed to the Nevada panel, since we hear cases from Washoe, the rurals, and also overflow Clark County cases. And it's our pleasure to be able to come down here to accommodate lawyers and litigants and parties rather than having to travel to Reno, rent a car, drive to Carson City, miss a whole day's work. Also, we have, I see members of the Attorney General's Office, members of the Public Defender's Office have been here, member of the Defense Bar are here, and it gives us, it lets us have an audience as to what we actually do as a panel in the Supreme Court rather than try to listen to it on audio or whatever. And now, Mr. Johns, if you're ready to open for on behalf of the appellant, Dr. Bass.
I believe I'm ready, Your Honor. Justice Gibbons and Justice Cherry. It's kind of difficult with, I think we had 14 issues and then we have consolidated cases to decide exactly what would be the best.
I can tell you, Mr. Johns, I'm very interested in jury instruction number 6 issue, which you objected to, and also the applicability of Jessica Williams versus State case 118 Nevada 536, how that impacts it among, I know you have other issues, but I'm a particular interest in that.
Let's see, number 6?
Yeah, on the intervening cause and
see, I had the other instructions all set out to look at, but
well, I don't want to delay you. I mean, if
no,
you want to get to
that's
it.
That's all right. I think that the proximate cause issue ties into one of my introductory remarks, which was going to be to talk about the duties and responsibilities of doctors in general pursuant to Chapter 630. And Dr. Bass, there's no question or dispute in this case, was a rather long time licensed medical doctor, and there's no dispute also but that his instructions to the patient were for 4 pills a day. And as we get into the destroyed evidence and the inability to really prove how much she took or whether she indeed took anything that he gave her, the causation factor or the proximate cause factor is a very important consideration. So I wasn't going to skip over that in my overall argument, but it does tie in to the fact that the pill bottle allegedly provided to her on October 4, 2005, which was missing 51 pills, that false evidence became absolutely necessary for the prosecution in order to overcome the proximate cause issue. Because anybody in their right mind would say, well, she got a, she took 51 pills in approximately one day that Dr. Bass gave her on October 4th. Therefore, that's kind of a no-brainer. The truth of the matter is that the pills or the bottle that the coroner's deputy located and identified as being provided her by Dr. Bass on October 4th was not the bottles or one of the bottles provided her on that date. And it was an Allscripts bottle that was either 2 months or 4 months ago, if it was indeed provided her by Dr. Bass. By the process of elimination, we can guess that it was probably 2 months ago. But with the bottle and the evidence being destroyed, it's impossible to really confirm that. And I think that's really the key element or the issue that I wanted to address was the destroyed evidence. What we had was a deputy coroner who had been with the department for about 6 months, and she quit or left about 3 months thereafter. She went to the scene, examined the body, couldn't find any other potential cause of death, no signs of trauma or anything. She took some photographs in what she described as the immediate scene. She found 3 bottles of prescription pills. One was the Allscripts bottle that was missing 51 pills, and there were 2 Imitrex bottles that had been prescribed for her. Both of those were empty. Also among the papers that were immediately available was Dr. Bass' patient report that was dated October the 4th. And she called Dr. Bass, and he said, yeah, I'd seen her on October the 4th. So she assumed that this half-empty bottle was provided on October 4th, and it wasn't. The next thing that she did was, and she made 3 vital mistakes, but you have to remember, at that time, this had all the earmarks of a overdose death. There was no big investigation or to-do going on. Dr. Bass's records were there. She talked to him, and that was that. So anyway, the next thing that she did was photograph the bottles and then flush the pills down the toilet and destroyed the bottle. She destroyed all of them. Wasn't anything to flush down in the Imitrex bottles. And she did her report. Her report identifying an October the 4th half-empty bottle of hydrocodone was available to the pathologist. He conducted very minimal tests and located some hydrocodone in the body. The conclusion was that that was the cause of death. Case closed. That was October 6th of 2005. So Amanda Burney's errors and mistakes, not properly photographing the bottles so they weren't legible, destroying the evidence by flushing it down the toilet, and assuming that the bottle she was looking at was provided on October 4th, rather than at some earlier date, which would be entirely consistent with her taking the prescription in accordance with Dr. Bass's instructions.
I guess, Mr. Jones, and I understand what you're saying. It's a shame it's not here, but I believe the standard, and I would disagree from the previous argument in thinking about this, defense have to show, number one, that the state acted in bad faith, and number two, that it resulted in prejudice to the defendant. So in this case, how would you say that this standard has been met?
Okay, well, we have to move ahead to the prosecution of the case to answer both the prejudice question and the bad faith. They're tied together. This case just remained dormant. Dr. Bass continued practicing. It was marked off as a overdose case until about 6 or 7 months later, when, unrelated to anything to do with the murder charge, and I realize we have all these other counts, and I'll try to address those rather quickly, but everything that was produced to prosecute Dr. Bass on practically any of the counts was based upon his own records. There was no expert testimony identifying any of the controlled substances in this case. And I think we argued about the prosecution overzealousness and misconduct. I also think, in going through my briefs, that the Page case wasn't specifically cited by either side, but none of the evidence or substances allegedly sold by Dr. Bass to anybody or seized pursuant to their search warrant were tested or confirmed as actually being a controlled substance. But in any event, trying to get back to your question, the state started their investigation to see just whether or not he was authorized to dispense controlled substance. Now, under Chapter 553, or whichever one it is, the he was authorized, according to their interpretation, to prescribe, but not to dispense. And this is a separate issue. I'm not going to belabor that, but is very important in some of the instructions given. But there was no death investigation at that time, but based upon certain preliminary investigation that he was, as he had been for 8, 9, 10 years, a house call doctor, and that he was giving prescribing controlled substances to patients and from prepackaged product that he received and stored through an all reputable drug distributor, that he was providing it to them at the time, and also prescribing medication. So they seized all of Dr. Bass's records. They seized all of his money, all of the medication, and all of his patient records, or I think since about 2000, pursuant to the search warrant, and those records all remained in the custody of the state until just shortly, actually, a few days before trial. And this gets into another issue, is the unpreparedness of his counsel, which I'm also not going to belabor, except for the fact that they did acknowledge that they had just received records and information, and we can always say that it should have been done beforehand, but wasn't, or that counsel was, could have done better. But in any event, they weren't ready. They acknowledged it. The judge denied the motion and said, "Well, you're never going to be ready." But during the review of his records, and incidentally in collaboration with the investigators from the medical board, they came upon the Gina McCauley records. These are the records that were mistakenly identified, the destroyed pill bottles, as being provided on October 4th. Mm-hmm. So the prosecution, or at that stage, whether the Attorney General's office was involved or just the FarmNet investigators, saw a golden opportunity to interpret the statute in such a way as to charge for the first time a murder count against a doctor. And this was the theory that they seized upon from the very beginning. If it hadn't been for Amanda Burney's mistakes, none of this case would ever have happened. We have referred to and cited in our briefs the initial affidavit of arrest signed by Amanda Burney, making it perfectly clear that the state's theory was that she died as a result of medication. Have I used it all up?
Yes. But finish your thought.
Medication provided to her by Dr. Bass on October 4th. This is the evidence that they extracted from their witnesses. We have quoted extensively from their opening and closing statements, and I've also set out several of the instructions, which I won't be able to get into, but take a close look at instruction number 5, where Judge Glass says, on or about October 4th through the 6th, and the entire case falls apart. We didn't want to.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
I'm going to give rebuttal. I'll give you 2 extra minutes on rebuttal, and Mr. Hafen, I'm going to give you 17 minutes instead of 15.
Justice Scalia, could I ask Mr. Johnson about one more issue, if I could, before he sits down?
Sure.
Mr. Johnson, you also alleged that Judge Glass did some improper things as far as how the trial was conducted, I mean, as far as her own conduct. What is it about her facial gestures, or what? I'm not sure exactly what
I didn't attend the trial.
Oh, okay.
Only a short portion of it, but the thing, I think Mr. Phillips, when he did call it to her attention, it was fairly descriptive of what he observed. The thing that really bothers me most, I would say, as far as the judicial approach and conduct, is some of her questioning of the jurors of the witnesses on very crucial issues, where she practically says Dr. Bass did not have a license to dispense, and as a matter of fact, we've got one quote in there where she says, "This is the bottle that you," that's when Dr. Bass was on the stand, "this is the bottle you delivered to her on October 4th. looking at a photograph of the bottle, which was illegible. And the other big problem that we have is all of the unreported conversations. When this proposed Exhibit 12 was being bandied around the courthouse, and that's a key exhibit on our that we first inspected after the trial was over, they had a conference unreported at the bench, and suddenly it was all dropped. And so I have no idea what was said, and I can't imagine if the contents were disclosed at that time. Mr. Hafen did participate in the trial, and I think his version is that she didn't want to open up the personal injury action being handled by Mr. Bernstein, but I have no idea whether that's true.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mr. Hafen, on behalf of the Attorney General's Office, 17 minutes. We give you the extra minute, and then they'll have 2 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Conrad Hafen. I represent the state of Nevada in this appeal. There are four reasons why this court should affirm the appellant's convictions. First, the statutes used to support the criminal charges are not unconstitutionally vague. Second, the prescription pill bottle that was destroyed did not prejudice the defendant and therefore did not violate his due process rights. Third, the conduct, the alleged conduct by the prosecutor and the trial court did not unfairly prejudice the appellant at time of trial and did not cause him to receive an unfair trial. And lastly, the trial court did not abuse her discretion when denying the appellant's motion for new trial. In regard to the first reason, the statutes used by the state in prosecuting this case were the statutes outlined in our murder statutes as well as the statutes outlined in Chapter 453. The murder statutes are very, very plain and concise, specifically subsection 2, which states specifically that if a person dies as a result of another individual providing them with a controlled substance in violation of 453, then that is murder. If you compare that statute, that subsection 2, to NRS 453.333, the language is almost identical. The only difference is in the subsection 2 of the murder statute, they use the word cause. In 453.333, they use the word proximate cause. Other than that small distinction, those two statutes are almost identical. They use precise terms. They use every ordinary language that everybody uses each day. And so an ordinary, intelligent person would understand that when they are being charged under those two statutes, what they are being charged with. And so we believe that the statutes used are very, very specific. And in addition to that, those statutes set forth a specific standard. As you go through the Chapter 453 and you look at the statutes that we charged Dr. Bass with, they refer to a specific step or a pecking order for liability. It begins with NRS 453.321. That's our cell with controlled substance. And in that statute, it specifically refers to controlled substances in Schedules 1 through 4. The controlled substances in this case were controlled substances in Schedule 3 and Schedule 4. As the evidence pointed out during trial, hydrocodone is a Schedule 3 controlled substance. The controlled substances in Xanax and Soma, carisoprodol, and alprazolam are both Schedule 4 controlled substance. And so in NRS 453.321, it specifically delineates what type of controlled substances are prohibited from being sold, from being transported, from being dispensed, lists a whole array of conduct. In subsection 1 of that statute, 453.321, it specifically says that a person is authorized to sell controlled substances in those categories only if they're in accordance with NRS 453.011 through 453.053. So what you need to do is you need to then go to the previous statutes and find out, is this person selling these controlled substances in accordance with those, that range of statutes? In this case, the statute we relied upon was the statute 453, let me back up, it's 453.011 to 453.553. In this case, we relied upon the statute 453.226, which is in that range, that if you're in compliance with any of those statutes, then you can sell those type of controlled substances in that category. In this case, 453.226 requires a practitioner to specifically obtain a registration certificate from the pharmacy board before he or she can dispense or sell a controlled substance, either a Category 3 or a Category 4.
So the purpose of these statutes is to require licensed pharmacies to sell these types of medications here, as opposed to people that are not pharmacies.
That's correct, Your Honor. If you want to be, if you're a doctor and you want to act as a pharmacy, and you want to sell controlled substances, you have to obtain a separate certificate from the pharmacy board that allows you to sell for profit these controlled substances.
So the doctors generally just write the prescriptions, and they're not involved financially, and they just have them filled at the pharmacy, which sells them to the customer, to the patient. Then, like
that's correct. With the exception of 230 doctors at the time we did this trial, the other doctors were simply writing out the prescription. And there's a huge distinction between writing out a prescription and then formally selling that drug for profit. Now, we've always maintained that Dr. Bask had the certificate to write out prescriptions, and that's not what he was being charged with. What he didn't do was what the other 230 doctors in this state did do. He didn't go back to the pharmacy board and obtain a separate certificate so that he could sell for profit those controlled substances. And that is what he's being charged with. So again, getting back to the simplicity and the straightforwardness of these statutes, it's very, very clear that if you're going to sell a controlled substance under Category 3 or 4, you have to first comply with NRS 453.226. And that compliance means that you have to go to the pharmacy board and obtain that separate and distinct certificate to do so.
Okay. And Mr. Haven, again, because I know the time is limited, and if you don't mind, if I could jump to another issue. On the proximate cause jury instruction number 6, it appears to me that the instruction was pretty much the same it was given in Williams versus State. Now, ironically, I was the judge in Williams versus State, and I had an additional part in the instruction about the contributory negligence issue, which was an issue in that case. But what's your position about the applicability of that instruction in Dr. Bass's case, and was it correct?
Yes, it was correct. If you look at 453.333, as I mentioned before, it has that proximate cause element in it. As the prosecutor on the case, that proximate cause and then the word cause in the murder statute caused a dilemma for me personally, because I didn't know, should I give a jury instruction on cause, tell them what cause is, or should I give them a jury instruction on proximate cause? And I determined, given the similarity between the two statutes, that cause in the murder statute did mean proximate cause.
Well, what about the issue? Excuse me. I think.
That's why we gave them the Williams instruction, because I felt that was the seminal case on proximate cause.
What about the issue, I think Dr. Bass has raised, that we should, you should have had an instruction to find an intervening cause and all like that. Well, what's your thoughts on that?
Well, I know that that was discussed at the time of settling jury instructions, and if there was a, I guess, evidence of an intervening cause, then that should have been provided. And I know that Dr. Bass's attorneys provided numerous jury instructions, and you can go to the record and show, and it will show what jury instructions were accepted by the court and what weren't. So, again, in this case, our position was there was no intervening cause to support that.
So your position, there was no evidence in the record which would support the court granting an intervening cause instruction?
That's correct.
Okay.
And I recognize, as a prosecutor, that you know, defense counsel is entitled to a jury instruction on their theory of the case. But they have to present, there has to be some evidence to support that theory of the case. And in this case, we didn't believe that there was sufficient evidence to support that type of jury instruction. In regard to reason number two, under Leonard, this court, and as Justice Gibbons, you noted, the standard for destruction of evidence is, was it done in bad faith, and was that evidence exculpatory, so much so that that would have prejudiced the defense at time of trial because they couldn't introduce it during trial. In this particular case, there was no bad faith, and clearly the prescription pill bottle that was destroyed was not exculpatory. In regard to the bad faith issue, keep in mind that Amanda Burney was a coroner investigator. She was not a homicide investigator. When she went to Gina McCauley's home the morning of October 6th, she was not investigating a homicide. She was there because there was a call, there was an apparent overdose, and that's why she was called out. And pursuant to the coroner's protocol, after examining the body, after going through the house, after discovering what she believed at the time was the pill bottle that may have caused the overdose, then and after properly photographing it and noting where she retrieved it, where she recovered it from, and how many bottles or how many pills were left in the bottle, then based on their protocol, she could flush the remaining pills down the toilet and she could destroy the bottle. I don't believe that there's anything in that scenario that demonstrates bad faith on the part of the prosecution in this case. Again, her investigation occurred at least a year before the criminal or the murder investigation began. And second, when she was there, there were no other police officers who were there investigating the murder case. There's no evidence to suggest that any other homicide investigator told her to destroy that evidence. She was simply following protocol. She has no bias, no interest in this case. She was simply doing what she was trained to do. The second part of the Leonard analysis, of course, is the exculpatory part of it. How, and I guess the question that this court's going to have to ask is, how would the preservation of that one Allscripts prescription bottle have been exculpatory to the defense? And the answer to that simply is it wouldn't. The state's theory of prosecution was that from June of 05 to October of 05, Dr. Bass had visited Gina McCauley on three separate occasions, approximately every 60 days. During those visits, he sold her 900 pills containing hydrocodone, another 90 pills of either Soma or Xanax. In addition to selling her those pills, he wrote her out a prescription for the same amounts. So ostensibly, she had access to almost over 1,700 prescription pills on every visit. And so the theory of the case was we had to show that he sold her, illegally sold her, prescription pills, Allscripts prescription pills, and that the Allscripts prescription pills containing hydrocodone was the proximate cause of her death. Now, whether that happened, whether those the pills that she took the day before she died were pills that he sold her in June, in August, or on October 4th, isn't relevant. They want to make it relevant because that fits into their conspiracy theory or the prosecutorial misconduct theory. But that was never, ever the theory of the case. And in fact, if you look at the closing arguments that I made, you'll see that I referenced not only the sale of the three separate bottles that he gave her on October 4th, but I also argued to the jury that you could look at the Allscripts bottle that was recovered by Amanda Burney back in October of 2005, and with that evidence, you could reasonably conclude that what killed her were Allscripts prescription drugs illegally sold to her by the appellant. Now, that was the theory.
Can certain dosages of like hydrocodone and Soma taken together be fatal?
Absolutely. And if you look at Chip Wells' testimony, he referred to that as a cocktail, a prescription cocktail. And the evidence showed that she not only had a high level of hydrocodone, but she had traces of the alprazolam as well as the caris-prodol, which would have come from the Soma as well as the Xanax. Again, getting back to the Leonard standard with the exculpatory nature of that pill bottle, it's not exculpatory at all. Now, I suppose that if that pill bottle had maybe been some other type of pill bottle, and they could say, well, the pills that she took from that pill bottle that were given to her by another doctor, that would have been an intervening cause, and maybe that would have been exculpatory. But that wasn't the state of the evidence. And so we don't believe that they've met their standard under the Leonard test to show that the destruction of that pill bottle was in fact done in bad faith, and that it was exculpatory evidence. In regard to the third reason, appellant has set forth several accusations, or made several accusations against Judge Glass and against me personally, in regard to judicial misconduct and prosecutorial misconduct. In regard to Judge Glass, under Hogan, this court ruled that judges are presumed to be unbiased. And so it's their burden to overcome that standard. As you look at their brief and their arguments today, they don't even come close to challenging Judge Glass and showing that she was biased in any way. The allegations concerning her statements that she made during the course of the trial were done outside the presence of the jury. And we don't believe that they've met their burden. We don't believe that they've met their burden showing that there was any prosecutorial misconduct.
Mr. Hayden, thank you.
Thank you.
Rebuttal? 2 minutes?
I can have a couple minutes.
Certainly.
First of all, I don't know where he's come up with his new theory of causation and the cause of death, but that was not the theory at the time of trial. That wasn't what was presented to the jury. We quoted it in our briefs. It's in volume 10 at 2001, where Mr. Hafen says in his closing argument, and he's talking about proximate cause there, she would not have died if she hadn't taken the hydrocodone that was sold to her by Dr. Bass on October 4, 2005, and he sold her three bottles. All of the bottles that Dr. Bass provided her on October 4th were turned over by the family to Ed Bernstein's office, and back to your question on bad faith, which I don't think I fully answered, Investigator Jennifer Rubart, who is a detective with the State Public Health Department, and it can't be argued she's only a coroner, she went to Attorney Bernstein's office and picked up all of those bottles. And no, she didn't pick up all the bottles. She didn't pick up the prescriptions that Dr. Bass gave for Walgreens, which she filled on October 5th. She didn't pick up the earlier prescription, I think, at another drugstore that she picked up. She only picked up the Allscripts bottles from Attorney Bernstein's office because, as we learned later at the meeting, where Mr. Sorensen looked at the tapes, the prescription drugs didn't fit their theory of the case. And this was in August of 2006, after the search warrant, and they continued to misrepresent and lie ever since, and Mr. Hafen has still never acknowledged when he found out that these October 4th bottles and the one that was destroyed was not provided to her on October 4th, or the ones that Bernie found.
Right. Just, sir, can I ask one more question to Mr. Johns? Mr. Johns, on the issue came up about the proximate cause instruction, and Mr. Hafen said there was no evidence of any intervening cause. And I'm interested in, I pulled that because I thought you had a very good argument on that point. What was the evidence of intervening cause that you feel justified a jury instruction on that?
Oh, we think that she, well, first of all, we don't think that she died from hydrocodone anyway, but that's a matter of conflict between the expert being unprepared, counsel being unprepared. It wasn't particularly well presented. But assuming that hydrocodone did kill her, we have her taking it in accordance, if it was provided to her earlier, then she's taking it in accordance with Dr. Bass's instructions. Four pills a day, that comes to 120.
So what's the intervening cause? Is she took too much or what? I don't understand the theory exactly you presented in the trial.
Well, Dr. Bass' trial counsel assumed that the pills that she got on the 4th were the ones that showed up, and if hydrocodone killed her, it did kill her. And so when they found her body on the 6th, she was in rigor mortis and been dead 4 to 8 hours or something. So, so there really wasn't any time. That's why it was so important for the state to harp on she took 51 pills from Dr. Bass. 48 hours. It kind of negates the proximate cause thing, but if you go back and look at it from the standpoint of she was taking pills, either pursuant to prescription or in excess, I think the Walgreens prescriptions, there's a question on whether or how much of those were taken, but there were two half-filled bottles in Bernstein's possession.
Right.
But anyway, it kind of...
I appreciate it. I think you answered
it. I know I haven't answered it, but it was just, if she was taking it in excess, then it was her responsibility.
Okay.
And of course, we think that the Emitrex is what killed her, but the coroner's office didn't bother checking for that.
Well, thank you, Mr. Johns, Mr. Sorensen, Mr. Hafen. This matter will stand submitted. We'll be